From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The Israeli tourism minister is in the United States to lobby against the U.S.-backed roadmap to peace. Who will he be talking to? Leaders of Congress and Christian fundamentalists close to the president. He believes Christians will launch a crusade to put an end to Islam. And the new U.S. TV station in occupied Iraq is being run by fundamentalist Christians. We'll hear a report. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. officials gave the first details yesterday of their plan to set up an interim Iraqi government. It will likely be headed by a council of as many as 9 leaders, the majority of whom would be drawn from U.S.-backed Iraqi exile groups that have yet to demonstrate popular support in Iraq. The head administrator of U.S.-occupied Iraq, retired Lieutenant General Jay Garner, said the nucleus of the interim Iraqi government would emerge by the end of the month. Garner named 5 figures who've already begun meeting. All were Kurdish or exile leaders who have long been backed and financed by the United States. They are Ahmed Chalabi of the Iraqi National Congress, Masoud Barzani of the Kurdistan Democratic Party, Jalal Talabani of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, Abdulaziz Hakim of the Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, and Ayad Alawi of the Iraqi National Accord. The Washington Post reports Garner visited Basra for the first time. After he met with hospital officials, an Iraqi man trailed him, carrying a small boy about 5 years old with both legs in casts. Blood seeped from the foot of one cast as the man tried to attract General Garner's attention. Garner, surrounded by bodyguards and aides, shook hands with the hospital director and, without appearing to notice the man, left to visit an oil refinery. The UN Nuclear Watchdog Agency, the IAEA, is urging Washington to allow it to investigate nuclear sites in Iraq that have reportedly been looted, but Washington has ignored the requests. The agency is concerned that radioactive material known to be stored at several Iraqi sites could pose health and environmental risks. There are also fears they could be used to create a so-called dirty bomb. Over the weekend, the Washington Post and New York Times ran articles indicating the U.S. had taken few measures to secure former nuclear sites. The Post reported the Baghdad nuclear research facility, Iraqis had been, quote, coming in by the scores over the last 2 weeks. Radioactive material is scattered around the site. The U.S. is saying it has captured Dr. Huda Salimadi Amash, one of Saddam Hussein's most senior biological weapons scientists. She's the number 53 on the U.S. list of 55 most wanted Iraqi leaders, one of the few women in Saddam Hussein's inner circle. This news from Gaza: the parents of a British peace activist who was shot in the head by Israeli troops came under fire themselves as they traveled to the spot where their son was critically injured. The London Independent reports Anthony and Jocelyn Herndl were in a British diplomatic convoy entering the town of Rafah in the Gaza Strip when Israeli soldiers at a checkpoint fired a shot which passed narrowly over the top of their vehicles. The Herndl's eldest son, Tom, is in a coma in an Israeli hospital after he was shot 3 weeks ago while trying to reach 2 Palestinian children. The U.S. military is preparing to release about 15 prisoners from the U.S. Navy prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. This includes as many as 3 boys aged between 13 and 16 years old who are captured in Afghanistan that have been at Guantanamo for more than a year. The Washington Post reports the Pentagon plans to expedite decisions about whether to prosecute, continue interrogating, or release more than 660 detainees held at the detention facility. This comes after criticism from Secretary of State General Colin Powell. A mission by three Southern African leaders aimed at resolving the political crisis in Zimbabwe by securing the departure of President Robert Mugabe ended in dismal failure yesterday. This, according to a report in the London Independent. South Africa's President Thabo Mbeki, the Nigerian leader President Obasanjo, and the Malawian President Bakili Mazuli jetted into Harare yesterday for meetings with President Mugabe in the hope that this would lead to a deal for the 79-year-old Mugabe's retirement and the installation of a new president from Mugabe's ZANU-PF party. The talks also included a representative from an opposition party that is challenging Zimbabwe's last election. Mugabe rejected any talks of stepping down until the opposition drops its lawsuit and recognizes him as Zimbabwe's official leader. University of California, Berkeley will turn away new students from SARS-infected China, Taiwan, Singapore, and Hong Kong this summer in what is believed to be the first such move by a major U.S. university to stop the spread of the virus. Meanwhile, in China, 10,000 people have been quarantined in the eastern city of Nanjing in a bid to contain SARS. In China, SARS has killed 214 people and infected more than 4,400 others. Newly released transcripts indicate that Senator Joseph McCarthy used closed-door sessions to winnow out witnesses who might have challenged him in the sensational anti-communism hearings 50 years ago. Of the 500 witnesses who testified in private, one-third were never called back to testify in public. Senate Associate Historian Donald Ritchie said, quote, "Anybody who stood up to McCarthy in closed session and did so articulately tended not to get called up in public session. McCarthy was only interested in the people he could browbeat publicly." McCarthy was a Wisconsin Republican who led the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations in 1953 and 1954 at the heart of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. His investigation into communists and the U.S. government was widely seen as a witch hunt and spawned the term McCarthyism to describe smear attacks. In the New York Times today, it says Aaron Copland, the composer, fiercely defended himself, declaring, "I have not been a communist in the past, and I am not now a communist." Langston Hughes, the poet, protested that he had not read much about Marxism, quote, beyond the introduction of the Communist Manifesto. And Dashiell Hammett, the mystery writer, invoked the Fifth Amendment, among nearly 500 others who were summoned to testify in secret before Senator Joseph McCarthy's committee. Congress may soon pass a controversial new law that would shield gun manufacturers and dealers from lawsuits filed by victims of gun crimes. The bill has been the focus of a major lobbying push by the NRA and a lesser-known organization called the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which has raised $100 million over the past 5 years from gun makers to fight lawsuits and fund its national political campaign. A recent article in the Washington Post quotes a top aide to a Senate Democrat who calls the bill "Things You've Got to Do to Get Reelected Act." A Colombian provincial governor, a former defense minister, and eight military personnel were killed in a failed rescue attempt near the northern Colombian town of Oral on Monday. They were among the 80 hostages that the FARC have been using to negotiate for the release of political prisoners. The Colombian government immediately blamed the rebels for the murders, which were described as execution-style killings. But a FARC spokesperson read a communique on local radio blaming the deaths on a botched rescue attempt by government forces. In the Philippines, the government has called off talks with the main Muslim separatist group, the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. This comes 2 days after about 30 people died in an attack by the group on Sunday. And a veteran of South Africa's anti-apartheid movement died last night. Walter Sisulu was 90 years old. Sisulu spent a quarter of a century in jail alongside his close friend, Nelson Mandela. They were both sentenced to life in prison for plotting sabotage and revolution and detained on Robben Island until the apartheid regime finally relented and released him in 1989. Sisulu was elected deputy president of the African National Congress in 1991. This was a position he held until after South Africa's first democratic election in 1994. Mandela said in a statement, quote, "His absence has carved a void. A part of me is gone. Together we shared ideas, forged common commitments. We walked side by side through the valley of death, nursing each other's bruises, holding each other up when our steps faltered. Together we savored the taste of freedom." And you are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinian and Israeli extremists are doing everything they can to sabotage the U.S.-backed roadmap to peace. Palestinian gunmen last night shot dead an Israeli settler and wounded two others in the West Bank. The attack came just hours after U.S. envoy William Burns met with recently installed Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah. Burns told Abbas and other senior Palestinian officials they must make every effort to stop attacks on Israelis. Burns said this is necessary to ensure progress on the U.S.-backed roadmap to peace. Meanwhile, Israeli tourism minister Benny Elon has arrived in the United States to lobby Congress and Christian fundamentalists against the roadmap. Elon is scheduled to hold a news conference tomorrow in which he will present a plan of his own. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports Elon's plan will call for the establishment of a Palestinian state, but not in the occupied territories. He will say the Palestinians should establish their country in Jordan. Elon is said in a statement, quote, "Our stay in Judea and Samaria is not temporary. Judea and Samaria are ancient Jewish names for the occupied West Bank." Elon is planning to lobby prominent Christian fundamentalists close to President Bush. An Israeli government spokesperson told the Agence France-Presse, "These religious leaders include Christian Coalition President Roberta Combs, former presidential candidate Gary Bauer, and Pat Robertson, founder of the Christian Broadcasting Network, who once said, 'God gave the land to the descendants of Israel. It was not given to Palestine.'" The Haaretz newspaper reports Elon said, quote, "What we are now seeing across the Muslim world is not a powerful surge of faith, but the dying embers of Islam. How will it disappear? Very simply. Within a few years, a Christian crusade against Islam will be launched, which will be the major event of this millennium." The tourism minister goes on to say, "Obviously, we'll be up against quite a large problem when only the two great religions of Judaism and Christianity remain, but that's still a long way off." We're going to start with Danielle Ben-Simon, who is a journalist with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, who wrote the piece that quoted the tourism minister. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Can you talk more about who the tourism minister is and more about what he said, this very blatant quote that says within a few years a Christian crusade against Islam will be launched?
Well, Mr. Elon is one of the first settlers in the West Bank, or Judea and Samaria, the way he calls them. He is an Israeli fundamentalist and really believes that the land of Israel was given by God to the Jews not the Israelis, but the Jews. And I would say that Mr. Elon represents the extreme right wing of in Israeli politics, and he is a member of Prime Minister Sharon's coalition. Not only that, he is the Minister of Tourism, so he is in touch with the international community, and he is now busy doing marketing for his peace plan, which is totally against Mr. Sharon's peace plan. For Mr. Benny Elon, the West Bank, as you said, belongs to the Jews, and the only place for Palestinians is in Jordan. So it's an old-fashioned view, but now revived and resuscitated by Mr. Elon. And I must say that it is doing it's not doing a good service to Mr. Sharon and his peace plan, and of course the American envoys in the Middle East.
Can you talk more about his relationship with Sharon, who he says suffers from a kind of founder's syndrome, and then why Sharon would allow him to come to the United States to lobby this plan supposedly opposed to Sharon's, or to the plan that Sharon's supposed to be supporting to get U.S. support?
Yes, I must agree with the essence of your question. I wonder why Mr. Sharon is allowing Mr. Elon to market a peace plan which runs counter the government peace plan and the roadmap. And I must maybe come to a conclusion that maybe deep in his heart, Mr. Sharon does not disagree with Mr. Elon. And otherwise, he would have called him back to Israel and maybe try to discipline him. But the fact that Mr. Elon, a member of the Israeli government, is trying to market a peace plan against the Israeli peace plan, raises a few questions. And I must say that about the Christian fundamentalists, we have now a new alliance between the Israeli the Jewish fundamentalist and the Christian fundamentalist as to the land of Israel. And it's never been so close like today when the American administration is trying to really put an end to this bloodshed in the area. Suddenly you have a Christian alliance with the Jewish fundamentalist trying to really torpedo this American initiative in the Middle East, and I can't tell you more than that. I don't know exactly what are the Christian fundamentalist motivations in trying to stop a peace plan. It seems to me that Israelis and Palestinians are now getting ready to do something in order to stop the bloodshed, and Benny Elon is in the United States in order to really to call for Christian fundamentalists to kill the roadmap, which he sees as a dangerous thing to Israel.
It's quite something what you write. You quote Elon as saying, "It's clear Islam is on the way to disappearing." And then you write, "Until then, the roadmap is stuck in Elon's throat like a bone." Like his settler colleagues, he too suspected Sharon's intentions from the beginning. His apprehension only increased in the wake of Sharon's interview with Haaretz last month, in which he ceded Beit El, Shiloh, Bethlehem, Elon, a resident of Beit El. Oh, and Elon comes from Beit El, one of the settlements. And he says,
That's
quote,
right.
"I felt a terrible pain. I even cried," he relates. "I told the others that we will fight Sharon with all our might. He should know that we will cut ourselves off from him long before Israel cuts itself off from Beit El." And says that Sharon suffers from a founder syndrome. He refers to people who established the state and fought for it, but were seized by weakness in their old age.
You know, talking about, he's got a point, Mr. Elon, as about the founder's syndrome. I must say, it's almost a tragedy in Israel that leaders try to make peace when they reach their 70s and their 80s. That's exactly what happened with the Prime Minister Menachem Begin when he made peace with Egypt, and with Prime Minister Rabin when he made peace with the Palestinians. He was already in his mid-70s, and now Sharon, in his mid-70s, is trying really to make peace with the Palestinians. So I must say, maybe there's something in this founder's syndrome that at the and almost when they're reaching the end of their life, they're trying really to do something in order to make peace. And Mr. Elon is as he said in the interview, he's really very worried about signs of peace that in Sharon's behavior, and unless Sharon is determined to go with this peace plan, Mr. Elon might win with the American Christian Coalition, because as I understand, they are very close to President Bush and to this Republican administration, and they might succeed in really killing the roadmap before it is applied in the West Bank.
Daniel Bell-Simon, I'd like you to stay on the line. We are going to a break, and then we're going to talk about the relationship between the Israeli government and Christian fundamentalists in the United States, why the tourism minister is coming here not only to lobby members of Congress, but to go through the Bible Belt. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Before we go on talking about the relationship between the Christian right in this country and the government of the State of Israel, I wanted to ask Danielle Ben-Simon, journalist with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, who has written about the Israeli tourism minister's trip to the United States, about the response of settlers to the so-called roadmap to peace.
Yes, well, I must say that for the settlers, the roadmap is a death sentence, because it calls for the freeze of the settlements and eventually for the dismantling of most of the settlements. So for the settlers, the roadmap is the end of life, and that's why they are fighting, and they're going to fight against Sharon in order to try to kill this plan, because the way they see it, a freeze of the settlements is a death sentence which will lead to the dismantlement of the settlements. And I must say that for them, as you mentioned earlier, it's a biblical land given from God to the Jews, and nobody, no official government, no democracy can really do something against the word of God. So it's not just a political problem. It is a religious, a fundamentalist problem. And I must say that we might see really a real war. But if the Israeli government endorses the roadmap, we might see the settlers fighting for their life. Because, as I said, the roadmap is perceived by them as a death sentence.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Danielle Ben-Simon, for joining us, journalist with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, as we move on to talk about the relationship between the Christian right and the Israeli government. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the Israeli tourism minister coming to the United States today to lobby not only presidential aides, members of Congress, but also members of the Christian right, the Christian Coalition President Roberta Combs, a former presidential candidate Gary Bauer, and Pat Robertson, founder of the Christian Broadcasting Network. We're joined on the line by John Grebe, who has written a piece for Counterpunch. You can see it at counterpunch.org, called Reverend Pat Robertson in the temple, channeling the word to the infidels. John Grebe also is a producer on Boston community radio station WZBC. And a shout out to all the folks at ZBC, broadcasting Democracy Now! Every day at noon. Can you talk about your piece, John, about Pat Robertson and the State of Israel?
Hi, Amy. It's good to be on the program. Reverend Dr. Pat Robertson, as he's called, visited the Temple Beth Shalom in Framingham, Massachusetts, on the Sunday before Passover. He was invited to this Jewish synagogue to speak by some of the congregants. And interestingly enough, the rabbi, Gary Green, of that synagogue, describes his congregation as politically liberal.
John, do you have a radio on or something that you could turn off?
No, there's no radio on. Is there a problem with the phone?
No, it's a little better. Thanks. There's just a little bit of reverberation on your voice. Feedback.
Okay.
Go ahead.
As I was saying, Reverend Pat Robertson came to speak in the synagogue, and he spoke in a way, I think, that disturbed a lot of the Jewish congregation in the synagogue, as far as I could notice. And there was a group in particular there, Jews Saying No to the Christian Right, who objected to Reverend Pat Robertson's extremely conservative evangelical Christian politics, but wanted to support his support for the United States' $3 billion of aid every year to the government and military of Israel.
We're also joined on the line by one of the people who came to the Pat Robertson event at Temple Beth Shalom in Framingham, Massachusetts, Marty Fetterman, with the group Jews Saying No to the Christian Right. Can you talk about the event and what you did?
Hi.
It's good to have you with us.
It's nice to be here. We created our group specifically because of Reverend Robertson's extreme right-wing views on a variety of subjects. Most of us there disagree strongly with his views on Israel and this kind of coalition that's growing between the right wing of the institutional Jewish community and the far right fundamentalist evangelical Christian right. But we were motivated by a broader kind of issue, which has to do with the historical disagreement between mainstream Jewish community and, I would say, ancient Jewish values, and virtually all of the rest of Robertson's agenda. The institutional Jewish community has been in the forefront historically of working against the kinds of views that he expresses on church-state relations, other religions, including other Christian religions, homosexuality, women's rights, family values, all of those things. And we felt very strongly that while we certainly didn't argue with the synagogue's right to invite him, that it's really very strongly not in the Jewish community's interest to have this kind of relationship with the far Christian right. It's interesting that groups like the Anti-Defamation League, which has published some years ago one of the best books on the Christian right and exposing the differences that we have, has now taken to publishing ads of people from the Christian right because of this very narrow and, I think, ultimately very self-defeating kind of support for this one issue about the far-right Israeli position that you were just talking to Daniel Ben-Simon about.
So can you talk about exactly what happened to you? Why did police come into the temple?
Well, we don't fully know. We know that the synagogue, as is normal for large events and certainly anything that has to do with Israel, arranged for this police detail While I have tried to contact Rabbi Green, he has not returned my calls, but he has said to a number of reporters that they got this detail in order to keep general peace, but did not ask them to chase away demonstrators or to arrest anyone or anything like that. We were really quite surprised when we got there. There were about 15 of us who planned to be there, hand out leaflets, give a short press conference. And when we got there, were very, very aggressively chased off the synagogue property by the police detail. One policeman in particular was very hostile and aggressive. We were not able to leaflet, although we held signs and did hold the press conference and gave a statement about why we were there. And at which point, those of us who had tickets went in, listened to Reverend Robertson, passed up in some questions, which were very controlled. There were parameters as what could and couldn't be asked, and questions went in by cards. There was no interaction at that point, and two of us left right after the question and answer period and went outside in the parking lot and were beginning to hand out our leaflets, which basically contained primarily quotes from Pat Robertson himself about a variety of issues. Suddenly, this police officer came out and told us we were trespassing, we had to leave. We expressed our feelings that we weren't doing anything illegal, but said that we would leave. We had decided beforehand that this was an educational, informational demonstration, and that we would not ourselves get involved in anything confrontational. But despite that, there was a tremendous amount of hostility, and we were yelled at, and were on our way out to go again just off the property, and this officer obviously didn't like me and was intent on doing something, and I was subsequently arrested for trespassing and disorderly conduct.
Marty Fetterman on the line with us, arrested at Temple Beth Shalom in Framingham, Massachusetts, protesting Pat Robertson's presence at the synagogue. We're also joined on the line by Professor Elaine Hagopian, who is a professor emeritus of sociology at Simmons College in Boston and host of Arabic Community Television in Boston. This quote that appeared in Haaretz of the tourism minister who's come to lobby against the peace plan in Washington, Elaine's comment, "It's clear Islam is on the way to disappear. Within a few years, a Christian crusade against Islam will be launched, which will be the major event of this millennium." Your response and the whole discussion of the Christian right now being courted by the State of Israel?
Well, first of all, I think that idea by Alon is very wrong. I mean, Islam is not going to disappear. The only thing right about it, correct about it, is that there is already being launched a Christian fundamentalist crusade. As you know, Billy Graham's son is supposed to be leading a quote-unquote humanitarian group to Iraq, and that they expect that they will begin some actions there. The new program that the U.S. has launched for Iraq is also run by a Christian fundamentalist organization. So they're now trying to convert Iraq, where already the supposed exile leaders say they will recognize Israel and that they will work with Israel. Now they're actually trying to convert the people. I think there's going to be a terrible reaction to all of this. But I think, Amy, we should go back even to 1978, when the Christian right, encouraged both by the right-wing Falange group, which happened to be predominantly Maronite right-wing, And the Israelis who operated in southern Lebanon even as early as 1978 had a radio program in southern Lebanon preaching the same kind of Christian fundamentalism. One can talk about Netanyahu during the period when he was prime minister, when he was upset with Clinton, and Clinton was not crazy about Netanyahu. He would come and speak to the Christian fundamentalists first to demonstrate to Clinton that he could go over his head, that they had a strong group support that he would not be able to overcome. So I think that this is something very serious that we need to look at. But as far as Islam disappearing, I think that's not only a mistake, and if they use the word crusade, that's when you're going to rally an awful lot of Muslim countries and people to really be upset. As it is, they are already upset with us.
We're also joined on the line right now by Russell McIver, who is the editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter. And he has published a column along with Rob Weissman, editor of the Multinational Monitor, talking about the U.S. government launching its Arabic language satellite TV news station for Iraq. Iraq is overwhelmingly a Muslim country, but according to McIver and Weissman, the newest TV station is being produced by a studio which is controlled by fundamentalist Christians who are also extremely pro-Israel. The studio, Grace Digital Media, also runs Grace News Network, which claims to be, quote, dedicated to transmitting the evidence of God's presence in the world today. The U.S. agency Broadcasting Board of Governors has defended the selection of Grace Digital, which they claim will have nothing to do with the editorial side of the news broadcast. Russell, can you talk more about this company that's been hired to produce the news for Iraq?
Good morning, Amy. Yes. Well, it starts with a company called Federal News Service, and most newsies here in Washington understand, know about this company. It's a company that goes around to press conferences and congressional hearings, and they tape record the events and bring them back and immediately transcribe them and transmit them to subscribers, primarily law firms, trade associations, people who can afford it, who pay big money to get immediate transcripts. And this company was built by a gentleman named Cordis Randall, who's born-again Christian, and he, a couple years ago, invited Cheryl Reagan, who's another born-again Christian multimillionaire from Arkansas, to one of his prayer meetings. And they got together, and she became an investor in his company, and he says she forced him out of his own company that he built over the years. So she has control of Federal News Service, which is his major transcription company here in Washington. And she also started, before coming to Federal News, something called Grace News Network, which, alarmingly, I think, says that it not only will be reporting secular news, but will report aggressive proclamations that will change the news to reflect the kingdom of God and its purposes. Now, she came to control a TV production studio, and the Broadcasting Board of Governors chose, which BBG sees themselves as the BBC of the United States, broadcasting sort of non-propaganda news. They control Voice of America, Radio Sawa, which is the Arabic language radio that's very popular in the Arab world. And so they want BBG, the BBC of the United States, wants to produce a Arabic language satellite competitor to Al Jazeera, and they're starting by doing this news broadcast to Iraq, which started last week, and they run the evening news show, the U.S. evening news shows dubbed in Arabic. So they run ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox. I think CNN declined to go along with this. And then they run 3 hours of their own news programming. And they chose Grace Digital Media to produce this this show. We also found out that that Grace News Network held a press conference here in the National Press Building last fall, in which they released a film called Israel: Divine Destiny, which is about, according to the website, Israel's destiny and the United States' role in that destiny. Although Thorne Ochter, who's the current CEO of Grace News Network, refused to show us a copy of the film, although they exist, and refused to get us a transcript. Thorne Ochter, by the way, some of your listeners might remember, is the former head of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration under Bush 1 and President Reagan, and was responsible for dismantling many of the worker safety protections under law in the United States.
John Grebe, you have written about Pat Robertson, not only about the relationship with the State of Israel, but also about Pat Robertson's broadcasting network. And I'm wondering if you're drawing any links or associations here.
Absolutely. Pat Robertson's helped to found the Christian Broadcasting Network. And incidentally, he sold an earlier a version of his network for over $1 billion, that's billion with a B, several years ago. So this is no small operation. He actually bragged at the synagogue in Framingham last month that the 1967 Six Days War was brilliant, and then he described when he went in 1982 to broadcast in Israel and in Lebanon, he wanted to bring his Christian message to the Lebanese. And he claims that the Lebanese in 1982 shot rockets to knock out his television transmitter repeater link to Beirut, Lebanon. He said that his competitor's television station was showing worldwide wrestling competition to over 1 million viewers. And then he said somebody sent them a tape of female mud wrestling. I'm not kidding. Those were his words. And he said somehow his Christian station broadcast it to the Lebanese. He said that's kind of chuckling. He said that they loved it, although more rockets knocked out that mud wrestling when the television repeater link was attacked. I think it's also interesting to note that Pat Robertson said clearly in the synagogue in April, he said, why not begin educating the Arabs? Take their TV and cut down their propaganda. So I think to look at Pat Robertson's business designs, and particularly in light of what Russell Mokhiber just said about this other business competitor and investor with the Federal News Service and now with the Grace News Network, I think we're seeing some kind of a business competition among these Christian broadcasters. I should just note, too, that another thing Pat Robertson said at this Jewish synagogue last month was that Wolfowitz and Cheney and Bush understand the spiritual significance. And that was said in the context of how he believes Ariel Sharon, known as the bulldozer, is strong. It makes me wonder about what Republican planners are desiring for the many politically liberal Jewish people here in the United States who often vote for Democrats. Republican planners may be looking at those potential Jewish votes and campaign dollars of the reflexively pro-Israeli Jewish Americans, not all Jewish Americans, but wondering if they might work out some kind of a bargain in order to attract those votes to the Republican Party.
As you listen to this conversation, Elaine Hagopian, last comments.
I think, first of all, everything that has been said is quite on target. I think it's very important to understand that if you just take this roadmap, for example, number one, I think that Ilan coming here really does kind of represent in some underhanded way Mr. Sharon. That was always his position in the past. Now, there are AIPAC and the Conference of American Jewish Presidents organizations who are backing an effort to block the roadmap. They don't say they're against the roadmap. They focus on the particular thing, the procedure that calls for concurrent and parallel steps to be taken. And what they are saying, and they have gathered 87 senators and 287 congressmen to send a letter to Bush saying you cannot put symmetry to these two parties because the Palestinians are the violent ones, the terrorists, and they must take actions first and cease all violence and cease all terrorism, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, stop the resistance. Now, this is really calling for something that is almost impossible for Palestinians to do. We know that Abu Mazen is weak. He cannot stop the violence because he really cannot promise anything from the roadmap that it's going to lead ultimately to a really viable state. Already, Bush's advisors are telling him not to push Sharon into making any kind of compromises that are involved in the procedures of this roadmap. There are not many concessions that are different from Oslo. As a matter of fact, they're somewhat worse. They're already telling him that if you want to get the conservative Jewish vote that supports Israel, this is not the way you're going to win them. And so they are focusing on his reelection, and therefore he has already said that he will not impose a solution on the parties, which means that Sharon and his government as the stronger party have free rein to do and set whatever conditions that they want.
Well, Elaine Hagopian, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Professor Emeritus of Simmons College in Boston. We've also been joined by Russell McIver of Corporate Crime Reporter, and John Grebe. His piece, Reverend Pat Robertson and the Temple, appears at counterpunch.org. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Christian cannons have fired at my days with a warning beneath the holy blaze and bow to our authority, say the cannons of Christianity. Oh, the children will be sent to schools. Minds of clay are molded to the rules. Learn to fear all of eternity. Warn the cannons of Christianity. Holy hands will count the money raised. Like a king, the Lord is richly praised. On a cross of diamond majesty, say the canons of Christianity.
Canons of Christianity. Phil Oakes here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. As we turn now to a conference that took place this weekend at the CUNY Grad Center in New York, that's the City University of New York, called American Spirit, Values, and Power, Resisting Empire, Affirming Our Vision. Among those who spoke was Leslie Kagan. She is co-chair of United for Peace and Justice, and she is also the chair of the Pacifica Foundation Board. This is an excerpt of what she had to say.
I think we really are at a pivotal moment. Of course, you know, as my introducer just said, who knows? History will tell when we look back at this moment how pivotal it has been, and more importantly, maybe what we've done with it, what we've done at this juncture in human history. I've been an activist, as you just heard, also an activist and social change organizer, peace and social change organizer, for about 37 years now, although I actually grew up in an activist family and recall the first demonstration that I remember being at was in the Bronx where I lived with my family, and there was a place where four or five different streets all crossed each other. I think it's called an intersection. And there was no traffic light there. There were a few stop signs, but no traffic light. And kids kept getting hit by cars. And the parents were quite upset and kept calling their city council people or, you know, appropriate people and getting no response. So one day the mothers in the neighborhood, my mother included, took a bunch of themselves and their kids and went out in the street, and we all held hands and, you know, literally block the intersection. Of course, it wasn't until many, many, many years later that I realized that not only was that one of my first demonstrations, it was actually an act of civil disobedience. So I feel privileged that I come from such a setting, such stock, if you will, where civil disobedience was not only an accepted activity, but actually encouraged. So I say that as sort of a backdrop to everything that we are thinking about and doing today. You know, perhaps we live in a time when more civil disobedience is required of us. And I do underscore the word civil here. I think there are many, many ways to be disobedient to the powers that be. I think our civility and our honesty and our courage are all part of what we bring to the table. Anyway, as an adult, it's been more like 37 years of organizing and activism. And I must say, while that's not a massive amount of time, although it feels like that sometimes to me, while it's not a massive amount of time, it's enough time for me to have some long view. I haven't been doing this for a week or a day or, you know, or even a year, but a long enough time to have some longer view. And it does actually feel like both the worst of times and the best of times. And I know I didn't say that, I didn't make that up, somebody else said it first. But it does actually feel on any given day like this is ridiculous. What are we doing? The powers that we're up against are so massive and so cruel and so mean-spirited and so powerful. What do we think we're doing? And then there are the other days where, and actually more of the other days, where I get up and say, okay, let's go. Precisely because things are so bad, how dare we sit back and not intervene and not inject ourselves in trying to turn things around. The good news is that there are massive numbers of people, not only in this city and in this country, but literally in every corner of the world, that have reached that point in their lives where they too are not sitting back, but have stepped up to the plate and said, we're going to do something. Just a word or two about the bad news, and I don't say this to bring us down or to assume that you don't already know this, but just to try and place the context here. Am I too loud or too soft? Hot mic. Okay. Is that better? No, that's too much. Okay, how's that? All right, just yell if you can't hear me. I love when speakers say that. If you can't hear me, raise your hand. Anyway, just to place some of this in a context, I don't want to, you know, sort of lay a bum rap on everybody about the bad news, but I do think we need to be honest in our assessment of the conditions that we're working in, that if we're not honest with each other, how are we going to, you know, figure out what it is that we need to do? And not only honest with each other, but honest with the people that we're trying to organize, the people that we seek to invite into this process with us. You know, on virtually any single level of life, whether it's at the community level, on the city, or national, or international level, there are serious, serious, massive problems, massive things that are wrong. Of course, given the work I do these days, I'm most attuned to this incredible military machinery that has not only been built, but is actually being used by the powers that be in this country virtually every day in one way or another. They may not be dropping a bomb every single day, although pretty much every single day, but they may not be dropping bombs or rolling the Marines through the lands of other people, but they use militarism in all the different ways that you can. You know, if you hold a gun to someone's head, you don't have to pull the trigger to be using that gun. You're still using it. And I think that analogy holds true for how they use the military. That the incursion into Iraq, the war, I don't even know if war is really the word, more like the assault against a mostly innocent population was as much a message to Saddam Hussein and the old rulers of that country as it was a message to people in every corner of the world that if you don't function, if you don't work the way we want you to work, we will send the Marines. Now, that message has been sent many, many times since the end of World War II, certainly, in many different ways. But this was yet another opportunity for them to say, not only will we use the military machinery we have, we have tremendous resources and every imaginable type of military advancement, if you can use that word, we have at our disposal. And it's not just that they have it, but again, there is this commitment at the highest level of this government to solve problems through militarism. You know, I remember when, I think it was at Columbine, I think it was after the Columbine shootings when Clinton was president, and he was like outraged that young people, you know, turned to violence. And I can't remember the exact words he used, but it was basically, he was trying to say, you know, where do they get this idea from? Hello? Where do they get this idea from? And I think that this is, that notion, the commitment to militarism is not just about a foreign policy. It's a commitment to violence and the use of force and militarism, obviously in different ways with different machinery available that runs throughout this culture. A number of years ago, the War Resisters League had started a campaign, and I don't actually know what happened to it, but a campaign to try and get rid of toy guns. The toys that little kids play with that teach them, you know, about militarism in a very hands-on kind of way. And I do think we need to think about that.
Leslie Kagan, co-chair of the United for Peace and Justice Coalition, an excerpt of her speech this weekend in New York at a conference called American Spirit, Values, and Power. And that does it for today's program. Our website is democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karam, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Rybel and Vil Katsouris. Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Underground and in the sky, animals and birds who live nearby are alive. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more we use from man? Can't you stand it?